Commanders General James D. Henry and Colonel Henry Dodge and their troops overtook Black Hawk and his followers after pursuing them for weeks over the marshy areas and rough terrain of south-central Wisconsin. Yet because of Black Hawk's superb military strategy, the steady rain and nightfall, approximately 700 Indians, including children and the aged, escaped down or across the Wisconsin River about 1 mile west of here. The historical marker, a mile and a half south of Sauk City on Highway 78, refers to the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, a key event in the last Native American war in Wisconsin. How did the short and inglorious Black Hawk War have a major influence on Wisconsin and American history? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Year.
How did the war begin, and what did Black Hawk hope to accomplish in it? How did he win the battle, but lose the war? Why did 23-year-old Abraham Lincoln volunteer to serve in the war? And how did a French Winnebago fur trader named Pierre Paquette play a key role in ending the war? Our guest is Patrick Young, professor at the Milwaukee School of Engineering and author of The Black Hawk War of 1832 and The Battle of Wisconsin Heights, which was published this year by the History Press.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Your last sentence in the book, The Battle of Wisconsin Heights, talks about the ghosts of the dead. Mm-hmm. I was thinking as I read through your book that we have all these ghosts around us just in the place names and the locations. You know, I'll go to events at Black Hawk Country Club, or there may be city names, you know, whether it's Prairie du Sac or others. It's as if the historical figures are still there. It must be especially so for you when you travel around Wisconsin, that the Black Hawk War is evident everywhere.
Yeah, I obviously I'm a lot more attuned to it than most people. You see a lot of things called Black Hawk. Like you said, Black Hawk Country Club, the Chicago Blackhawks hockey team. So especially when I went to college at UW-Whitewater when I was an undergraduate, certainly there's a lot of things around Fort Atkinson and Whitewater named after Black Hawk. So, yeah, I do notice all of them.
What was your experience as you walked around that battlefield? What's it like today?
Well, today it's a state park. It's basically a wooded area. It's not built up or anything. There's few farms around it, but the battlefield itself is just sort of pristine woods and everything else. It's probably a bit more overgrown. From what I've read, it was more like an oak stand when the battle happened. Probably a lot of the trees were stripped down by settlers, and then you don't get the old growth forest. You get a lot of underbrush and everything. But it's still very well preserved, and the two hilltops that, you know, where the two sides fought are very easily discernible once you get there.
You had already written a book about the Black Hawk War and then decided to focus in on this one battle. What made you think that the Battle of Wisconsin Heights in 1832 deserved sort of its own separate study?
Well, when I was writing my first book on the Black Hawk War, I mean, it became immediately evident that when you look at all the little, you know, military actions that made up this whole war, the vast majority of them were just really tiny skirmishes. In modern military parlance, they would call a firefight, something that's not really decisive, you know, relatively small bodies of people shooting at one another. Then there were out-and-out retreats, like the first battle called the Battle of Stillman's Run. And then there were outright massacres, like the last battle, the Battle of Bad Axe. And as you start looking at all these little battles, there's a real lack of drama in any of them. But the one battle that actually involved, I guess, the classical military stratagems of fire and maneuver, relatively large bodies of men, was the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. It was also the most dramatic, and you know, it was the one real classical military battle of the war. And when I was writing my first book on the Black Hawk War, I said, you know, this really kind of deserves its own treatment, not necessarily for, you know, the purpose of military history or, you know, trying to say something new about the war, but just because of the drama of it. And then the History Press contacted me about a year ago and said, well, do you have any projects you'd like to take on in a relatively short paperback book? And I said, you bet I do. Battle of Wisconsin Heights.
Well, let's sort of set the stage for the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. You talk early on in the book about Black Hawk having signed some treaties, but not necessarily knowing what he was signing away and saying at one point, I think he states, the white people were in the habit of saying one thing to the Indians and putting on paper another.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the origins of the Black Hawk War go back to 1804. And it was that year that the Sauk and the Fox, and they were two tribes that were separate, but they were very tightly confederated. They had signed a treaty with the United States government that ceded virtually all of western Illinois, part of southwestern Wisconsin, and part of a little bit of Missouri to the United States. And they had been tricked into it by the territorial governor of Indiana, who was the primary treaty negotiator, William Henry Harrison, who went on to win the Battle of Tippecanoe during the War of 1812 and served for 1 month as president. And Harrison was an unabashed American expansionist. He thought America had to expand all the way to the Pacific if need be. And the only way to do that was to buy land from the Indians. And sometimes the only way to do that was to swindle them. And that's what he did. He basically had a group of Sauk chiefs, not Black Hawk in 1804, but a group of Sauk chiefs who signed a land cession treaty. They didn't know how much land they were giving away. They thought it was probably just a little bit of land in Missouri they weren't using. And then they find out later it's their whole homeland. And a lot of Sauks disagreed with the treaty. Black Hawk was one of them. So you had this large faction among the Sauks and a smaller faction among the Fox who were determined to fight the treaty to the end. Black Hawk signed a treaty of peace in 1816 with the United States, which was a post-war of 1812 treaty, which ended the Sauk and Fox's hostility toward the U.S. And he didn't know it, but there was a provision in there that said he accepted the provisions of the 1804 treaty without reservation. And he was just angry as all get out when he found out about that. So there were essentially two treaties that said, you're selling this land to us. And in both cases, the United States essentially just tricked the Indians into signing it.
The Indians never had a lawyer, did they, at least not in most cases?
No, they didn't. And they just weren't told the contents of treaties. Not every treaty was negotiated in bad faith, but a lot of them were. And this was one of them. And Harrison just had this, this penchant. I don't know how else to describe it. Any way you could get any Indians to sign a treaty, whether it was people who were in the leadership positions qualified to sign them or not, it didn't matter. He was just going to remove the Indians any way he could.
Well, he had a lot of company in that philosophy.
Yeah, but he, of all the I guess, Indian swindlers out there, William Henry Harrison stood head and shoulders above the rest. He was a piece of work, as they say.
In your book, you mentioned briefly that Abraham Lincoln became involved, not directly in the fighting, but in part of this. And I liked the quotation you had from him about the bloody struggles with the mosquito.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Lincoln signed up for the war right away. And he wasn't the only one. In the years after the Black Hawk War, virtually every politician in Illinois who wanted to make a name for himself and get elected, they had to be a Black Hawk War veteran. I mean, this is before the Civil War. After the Civil War, that became the new the new veteran status to have. But in the 1840s, 1850s, Black Hawk War veterans were seen as, a cut above the rest. So if you want to have a political career, I think he knew intuitively that he had to serve in the Black Hawk War. And there were like 6,000 Illinois and Michigan territorial citizens who did.
Now, Lincoln, was he in the militia or was he he would have been in the sort of the less disciplined group, wouldn't he, compared to the actual Army regulars?
Yeah, the vast majority of people who served, whites who served in the federal forces during the Black Hawk War were militia. I mean, the way they did it is they would have, every adult male was enrolled in the militia in every state in the Union. What they did in Illinois is they basically took the everybody who was enrolled in the militia. They asked for volunteers. Anybody who volunteered was basically, and they didn't have to draft anybody. They probably could have, but they didn't. They had more than enough volunteers.
The code of conduct was such that you actually could win some, as you say, political capital, but also just personally, too, even if you didn't have political ambitions, it would be a feather in your cap.
Yeah, and you got paid while you were doing it. It wasn't a lot of money, but I think Lincoln was at the time between jobs, as they say. So it was a good move for him, from that standpoint. The number of federal soldiers, regular Army soldiers, was so tiny at all the little garrisons around the upper Midwest that they had no choice but to rely upon militia volunteers.
And what sparked the conflict then that became the Black Hawk War?
Well, by 1829, the federal government finally told the Sauk and Fox, look, you sold this land in 1804. Now we want to survey it and sell it to settlers, and you need to move. Most of the tribes, both the Sauk and the Fox, reluctantly went across the Mississippi into Iowa. But there was a determined group under Black Hawk who said, no, we're going to stay. And I think Black Hawk's plan initially, he didn't want to start a war. That was not his intention. He crossed the Mississippi in April of 1832, hoping that he could attract enough support from other tribes in the region. The Potawatomi still were living there, the Winnebago. And I think he hoped that if he could sort of rally enough support, he could sort of, have this good, strong show of force and basically, play chicken with the federal government and have them blink and hopefully renegotiate a treaty. He was also hoping to get the support of the British in Canada.
Because the Indians had been allied with the British during the War of 1812.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that was still a hope among the Indians that if there was another war, the British would come to their assistance. So he wasn't completely out in left field with all this. I mean, Tecumseh had done it during the War of 1812. Black Hawk was essentially just a latter-day Tecumseh, just a lot less successful. So, but the problem was by crossing the Mississippi, he had promised he in 1831 that he would stay across the Mississippi in Iowa. He crossed back into Illinois in 1832, and he had a group of his warriors had the unfortunate circumstance of meeting up with a group of drunken Illinois militiamen, and that sparked the first battle. And once shots were fired, once violence had been resorted to, it was really difficult to find a peaceful solution. I think it could have been peacefully resolved. But once, people were dead on both sides and there had been this initial battle called the Battle of Stillman's Run, it was just, finding a peaceful solution was just not possible.
And the Battle of Stillman Run that you're talking about, the first shot fired was actually against an Indian, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And where does Henry Dodge come into the story? You call him sort of the consummate frontiersman, central figure in this narrative.
Well, he was living in southwestern, what is today southwestern Wisconsin. In 1832, it was Michigan Territory. He was really a consummate frontiersman, born in Indiana, which was, frontier, lived in the salt mines and lead mines of Missouri as a teenager, fought in the War of 1812, and I think he might have attained the rank of brigadier general. By the 1832, he was living in southwestern Wisconsin, mining lead, probably making good money doing it. He was a colonel in the Michigan Territorial Militia. He had fought in another Indian uprising in 1827 against the Winnebago. So he had a lot of military experience. He had a good-sized lead mining operation in what's today Dodgeville, Wisconsin. So as soon as the Black Hawk War started, he wrote to Henry Atkinson, who was the federal commander in charge, wrote to the Illinois governor and basically offered his services. And Henry Atkinson had worked with him before, so he was more than happy to accept his services.
Was it the lead that actually was, the sparking the conflict? Was it because the lead attracted the Americans into southwest Wisconsin
in
the first place?
The lead mining and lead miners, that was the spark that had caused the 1827 Winnebago uprising. But the Black Hawk War, lead didn't really play much of a role in that at all. The lead mines were mostly on what was Winnebago territory or Ho-Chunk territory. The Wisconsin-Winnebago now call themselves Ho-Chunk. The Fox Indians also mined lead, although they tended to go up to what was then Dubuque Mine. So now, lead mining didn't play that much of a role in the Black Hawk War. It was really sort of a minor circumstance.
You call Stillman's Run a fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
How was it a fiasco, and how did it go from there to the Wisconsin Heights battle?
Well, at the time, Black Hawk was in the vicinity of what's today Rockford, Illinois. He was trying to woo the local Potawatomis to his cause. As I said, he was hoping to sort of create this show of force. They weren't interested in supporting him. They said, this isn't going to work. By that time, he had sort of started to realize that his plans were not coming together as he hoped. And it's about that time that Isaiah Stillman's battalion of Illinois militia was in the area. They had been drinking heavily. I mean, they had a lot of whiskey with them. And a group of his men came into contact with a group of Black Hawk's warriors a little bit south of Rockford in what's today, I think it's Stillman's Valley, Illinois. And again, it was just, it's, to make a long story short, you just had drunken militiamen firing on Indians, Indians firing back. And it sort of started with this relatively small confrontation between, you know, these small groups of Indians and these small groups of militiamen. Ultimately, Isaiah Stillman took all 280 of his men and charged, you know, where Black Hawk and his warriors were. And with a mere 40 warriors, he basically started, you know, his warriors started shooting in very disciplined volleys. Stillman's men were not very experienced in warfare. They were drunk. And once they started receiving fire, heavy fire from these 40 Indians, all 280 of them just broke ranks and fled back to what's today Dixon, Illinois.
So the run means retreat.
Yeah, run, retreat, yeah. And they all just kind of, they you know, they were camped not too far from where Black Hawk was. They didn't even bother to stop at their camp. They just retreated 30 miles to what's today Dixon, Illinois.
And so would the humiliation of that then have sort of been a catalyst for why the choice was made to go after Black Hawk?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 12 of Stillman's men had been killed. So now, I mean, you can't find a peaceful solution. You know, blood's been shed. And there was just sort of this idea in Indian wars that, you know, if Indians rose up, you know, if you didn't punish them severely, that would just, you know, give other Indians the idea that they could possibly rise up against the federal government. And so there was just sort of this common set of ideas about Indian warfare. If Indians rise up, if Indians, you know, basically revolt against the federal government in any way, shape, or form, they have to be punished severely, if for no other reason than to be an example to other Indian tribes, other Indian communities.
Was the fact that Andrew Jackson was president significant? In other words, was some of the impetus coming from the White House?
Well, he basically told Atkinson, find and defeat Black Hawk, kill him if you have to. But he, you know, at the same time, you know, I don't think it would have mattered who would have been in the White House. There was just a common set of ideas, especially among Army officers, about how to deal with Indians. First of all, they liked, you know, believe it or not, the Army, at least I would say in the 1820s and 30s, they really tried to avoid fighting Indians because it was expensive. There was no guarantee you were going to succeed. So if you could just keep Indians quiet, if you could just convince them to move off their ceded land and do it peacefully, that was always preferable. But once war started, it was basically this idea that you had to fight it very violently. There was really no, you know, differentiating between men, women, and children. And if you had to basically come down hard on recalcitrant tribes, so other tribes didn't rise up as well.
The Indians seemed to feel similarly that, you know, war is expensive for them too.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was to be avoided, but once that line was crossed, mm-hmm. That they had to also respond with force, mm-hmm. And that would be indiscriminate.
Well, Indians had a very different set of ideas about the purpose of warfare. First of all, most of what they believed that warfare was largely an individual activity that males basically engaged in for social prestige. And when they went to war, it was largely one warrior fighting another warrior. Rarely did they really have larger strategic goals. It was really sort of their cultural view of war was sort of individual honor, individual prestige. And for that reason, you know, they fought differently than whites did. They had a different reason for fighting. So when they went to war, they took scalps, for example, because that was proof that you had killed someone. But again, when whites went to war against Indians, it was the idea that you had to chastise them. You had to, you know, basically exact violence upon them, if for no other reason, just to make them an example to everybody, all the other Indian tribes in the area.
Scalping come from where originally? I mean, you hear sometimes that it was actually originated with the British as a way to count the number of casualties that you had inflicted.
Well, this is something that I've been meaning to research for a long time. There's actually been quite a bit written on it. I don't think scalping originated with Europeans. I think this was something Indians were doing anyway. One of the things that I've realized as I've, you know, looked at Indian warfare, when the French and the English first came to North America, what Indians did is they didn't take scalps. They tortured their captives, often in very harrowing ways. I think there was a transition from torturing a living captive to desecrating a corpse by taking a scalp. But I think there was so much involved in taking a scalp and the scalp dance that they had. They had a pole with all the scalps on it when they returned from war. I think that developed. It was convenient for the British that they could count scalps, but I think that was something that evolved largely from the Indians themselves.
But you have quite a few accounts that were quite chilling for me to read of the white militia here, or the white army, the volunteers taking scalps from the Indians, which is not the way it's normally portrayed.
No, and I think that was just part of frontier warfare. During the Black Hawk War, if Indians killed a white man, they'd take a scalp. Just, I think, sort of as revenge. When whites killed Indians, they took their scalps. I think it was more whites just sort of copying Indians. And again, I think there was just this idea among, you know, among white frontiersmen and among federal officials that you almost can't punish the Indians too much if they've risen up. You really have to, you know, make them an example, again, if for no other reason, just to show other Indian communities what could happen to them. So,
are we talking about a lot of settlements in northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin by 1832, and Indian settlements of any size? These all sound like such small groups. It almost sounds like this is all happening away from any kind of settlement.
Well, in 1832, the only – and when we with the most heavily settled parts of the upper Midwest were really in southern Illinois. Once you got north of the Illinois River, you had some small scattered settlements – like the big Indian Creek settlement where the Potawatomis had a massacre during the war. That was probably fewer than 30 people. When you got north of, you know, the Illinois River, there were, again, very tiny little scattered settlements.
Chicago, virtually non-existent.
Well,
Milwaukee.
Well, as far as settlements, I mean, there were several different types. There were Indian communities, and those were the most common in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin. Then in southwestern Wisconsin, you had lead mining settlements, and those generally were very temporary. But then you also had fur trading settlements, and those were several centuries old, like Green Bay, Chicago, Milwaukee, Prairie du Chien, Portage. These were basically mostly old French families, many of whom had intermarried with the Indians. So there were different types of settlements. There were different types of communities. North of the Illinois River, there weren't that many white Americans, I guess. There were a lot of mixed French Indian families. There were quite a number of Indian communities. And then there were occasional white American families who had come from, you know, the East. At Dixon, Illinois, which it was then called Dixon's Ferry, there was a guy named John Dixon there who I'm not sure why he was settled there, but you know, he was a good 100 miles from the larger Illinois settlement. So, yeah, it was very thinly settled by white Americans. There were a lot of Indians and mixed French Indian communities, and that was about it.
We'll follow the Black Hawk War to its culmination at the Battle of Wisconsin Heights when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Patrick Young, who has written a book about the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. You might call it the high point of the Black Hawk War of 1832, the last Native American war in Wisconsin. It started ingloriously for the white military forces, this so-called Battle of Stillman's Run, where although they outnumber Black Hawk's braves, end up retreating in disarray, I gather they wanted to somehow correct their reputations at this point. What is Stillman in charge or is somebody else in charge?
Well, no, Stillman was he commanded a battalion, just a relatively small component within the whole federal army. Okay, and most of the federal army was made up of militia, small number of regular army units. Stillman was just one small battalion. He just happened to be in command of the battalion that stumbled upon Black Hawk and his warriors. What happens after Stillman's Run is, again, Black Hawk, I think, lost three warriors at the Battle of Stillman's Run. Stillman lost a total of 12 men. So now Black Hawk knows that, you know, Atkinson, who commands all the military forces, is coming after him. So he retreats up to what is today Fort Atkinson around Lake Koshkonong. And his plan is to hide out long enough, evade the army, and somehow sneak across Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, back to the Mississippi River, and go back down the Mississippi River to the country of the Sauk and Foxes, which was basically centered around Rock Island, Illinois, Moline, Illinois. After the Battle of Stillman's Run, the militia forces that Atkinson had, they'd only been mustered in for a month, and they ended up being dismissed after a month. So he had to raise a new army of militia, and he worked with the Illinois governor, John Reynolds, to do that. Now, in the meantime, in the interim between the Battle of Stillman's Run in May and the Battle of Wisconsin Heights in July, you know, Atkinson's building a new army. Black Hawk takes his warriors out on these small raids against white settlements, largely in, you know, western Illinois. He's trying to basically throw Atkinson off his trail, hoping that Atkinson will commit any new forces to, you know, western Illinois and Black Hawk's in eastern Wisconsin, and he can somehow scoot around Atkinson's army. They're, the Pottawatomie and the Ho-Chunk, they also initiated a series of small skirmishes and raids against scattered white settlements. And again, like you were saying, Emily, you have all these little historical markers all over Wisconsin, Illinois. And some of these, you know, historical markers make these battles sound like, you know, they were, you know, these great glorious affairs. And they were just tiny skirmishes of sometimes fewer than a dozen people, sometimes as many as 40 or 50. But it was really just a series of skirmishes, indecisive, largely, you know, not accomplishing anything between May and July of 1832.
You write about how not only do you have the casualties that occur during these skirmishes, but also you've got cholera and starvation taking lives.
Well, cholera didn't really happen until, you know, early July. And what happened by early July, Atkinson had formed a new army. And in late June, he marches from Dixon's Ferry, Illinois, which is today Dixon, Illinois, up to Lake Koshkonong. Black Hawk basically has scouts out seeing the army's movement. He retreats up to what's today Hustisford, Wisconsin, then called the Rock River Rapids. And so he's still basically out of reach of Atkinson's army. By this time, this whole thing's been going on for a better part of 2 months. Andrew Jackson's just very impatient. It's an election year. He's got all sorts of problems in Washington with what was called the Bank War, which was the really big thing happening in Washington.
With the National Bank.
Yeah, with the National Bank. Second Bank of the United States. Anyway, he didn't need another headache, not an election year. So he had another general, Winfield Scott, take an army of regulars from the eastern garrisons and depart to Chicago. But by the time they got to Chicago, most of them didn't even get there. Cholera had broken out on the East Coast, and these troops were just loaded with cholera. They started dying on the way to the upper Great Lakes. Two of the steamships didn't even make it, you know, barely made it out of Detroit. They're just, you know, the soldiers just panicked and ran off the boats. The two boats that did get to Chicago out of the four, several dozen soldiers had died by the time they got to Chicago. And the rest of the troops had so much cholera, Winfield Scott, he didn't even want to take his troops out. He was afraid that Atkinson's troops would catch it. So Atkinson remained in command of the theater, mainly because Winfield Scott's army of 1,000 regulars showed up with so much cholera. It didn't really affect anybody fighting in the war because Winfield Scott was smart enough to keep all of his infected troops at Chicago. But Henry Atkinson wasn't even in command of the whole Western Division. That was another general who was in Tennessee with rheumatism at the time. So it was sort of by double default that Henry Atkinson was even in charge at all. So
was this all pretty much a foot battle? Not involving cavalry.
No, it's pretty much a cavalry battle. Yeah, it is. Black Hawk had 500 warriors, each of whom was mounted on, they said Indian ponies, but I think ponies was just sort of a term they used for any Indian horse. So yeah, his warriors were mounted, although they didn't fight like cavalry. They pretty much just used the horses to for transportation, and then they fought dismounted, you know, kind of like dragoons, I guess would be the proper term. The reason the Illinois militia were so important is because the Army didn't have cavalry at the time. All the Army regulars were infantry. There was no U.S. Army cavalry at the time, so all the Illinois volunteers were mounted as well. And the horse was essentially just for transportation. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons the U.S. created cavalry regiments after the Black Hawk War is they saw that they couldn't fight mounted Indians with just, you know, foot soldiers. So the battles were fought on foot, but they moved to the battle, you know, all around by horse.
You write about how some of the people who were fighting, when they passed through the area in around Madison and Middleton with the Lake Mendota, Lake Monona and so on, took time out to write a little bit about how beautiful it was, but also complained about the brush they had to go through.
Yeah, and one of the things, every time I drive to Madison, once I get around Oztalon, I mean, it was around Oztalon that, roughly around there, that, you know, after Black Hawk and his people left what's today Hustisford, because by that time, Atkinson hadn't figured out where he was, but Henry Dodge and James Henry, two of his subordinate commanders, they had figured out where Black Hawk was. Black Hawk basically went back down the Rock River with his people. They, you know, basically, they started marching westward around where Oztalon is. And basically, you know, they marched westward roughly along the same terrain that, you know, I-94 goes today. So when you drive on I-94 between Oztalon, around Oztalon and Madison, you're essentially going over the same ground Black Hawk did. And, of course, the militia volunteers who were in pursuit of them. And then when you are on the Isthmus, okay, well, the Black Hawk and his people went right down the Isthmus. That was the really heavy undergrowth there, right in the Isthmus between Lakes Monona and Mendota.
And then, a lot swampier then than it is now.
Yeah, yeah. And so every time I look up State Street, I mean, that's essentially what they were, you know, that was their path. They you know, I-94, then, you know, they went down the Isthmus down essentially where State Street is today. They turned, went west right through what's today the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And I'm pretty sure this is something I have to research more, but in the day before the battle, Black Hawk had set up two ambush positions on high ground south of Lake Mendota. And I'm pretty sure one of those was today essentially Bascom Hill, or at least that whole area there.
And then they went up to what is now the Pheasant Branch Conservancy on the north side of the lake.
Right, exactly.
Camped there for a night and headed up toward the Wisconsin River.
And I think that's Highway 12. So, yeah, if you take I-94 into Madison and then take, you know, State Street all the way down the Isthmus, and then if you can catch Highway 12, you're essentially taking the exact same route that Black Hawk and the pursuing army took.
And what did Black Hawk have to worry about besides sort of feeding his people as they were trying to escape?
Well, that was the big one. I mean, I think a lot of people have misconceptions about at least Indians in the Midwest. They think that they could live off the land. Well, to an extent they could, but they were farmers. They grew corn. And they had to leave, you know, when they crossed the Mississippi in April, they only brought a limited amount of food with them. Their plan was to, you know, again, make this strong show of force, grow corn with the Winnebago or, you know, probably northern Illinois or southern Wisconsin. And again, that was just completely dashed. So they don't have a lot of food. And they resort to eating bark and anything else they can. So they're starving.
They also have women and children.
They also have women and children.
Don't have to worry about.
Right, the militia didn't have to worry about that. And, of course, they've got 500 horses, but they got well over 1,000 people. So there's a lot of stresses on Black Hawk's people.
The subtitle you give your book is Thunder on the Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the subtitle?
Well, I guess to kind of pick up the story and take it to the Wisconsin River, again, two of Atkinson's subordinates, Henry Dodge and James D. Henry, figured out that Black Hawk was hiding out at the Rock River Rapids. Black Hawk somehow figured out that they were en route to the Rock River Rapids to intercept him. I think, you know, both sides had a pretty good network of scouts and spies out there.
We're talking about 1,000 people on the move, after all.
Right, yeah.
Impossible to keep track of.
Right, and, people moved on pretty well-defined paths and everything back then. Well, one of a Winnebago scout working for Dodge found the trail of Black Hawk's people after they had departed the Rock River Rapids. And again, they picked it. You know, they picked up the trail around Oztalon, and it went right, you know, to the Isthmus between Lakes Mendota and Monona. Black Hawk was about a day, maybe 2 days ahead of Dodge and Henry. And Henry and Dodge, just without even asking Atkinson, they just began to pursue Black Hawk and his people. And they hoped to catch up with them and basically just destroy his whole band of Indians. But on the night of July 20th, Henry Dodge and James Henry, they camped out north of on the north side of Lake Monona. Black Hawk and his people were camped out, again, near Middleton, the Pheasant Branch Creek Conservatory. The next day, Dodge said, "We're going to catch these Indians. We're going to, you know, we're going to basically destroy Black Hawk and his people." So they started at dawn on the morning of the 21st, and they went down the isthmus, you know, the heavy brush and everything. They rounded the southern shore of Lake Mendota. Black Hawk and his people were moving much more slowly, just because they had women and children. And Black Hawk actually got to the Wisconsin River and started having his people cross, hoping he could get them across before the militia came. Because once you have the Wisconsin River between you and the militia, you're going to be at least safer. But Dodge and Henry were moving faster, and they caught up, well, probably about, you know, between 3 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon on July 21st. And Black Hawk decided, well, I've got to fight a delaying action now. Okay, I don't have a choice. If I'm going to get my women and children across, I'm going to have to take a small body of warriors. I don't have to defeat the militia, but I got to hold them back for a few hours while we finish crossing the river. And so what happens is the lead elements of Dodge and Henry's forces actually get to the Wisconsin River where Black Hawk and his people are crossing. Black Hawk's warriors throw them back, and this lead scout element falls back about a half mile from the river and basically settles in on a ridge, a piece of high ground. Black Hawk's warriors take up a position directly south of it on another piece of high ground. And these scouts were about maybe a half hour ahead of the main body. And by about 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the afternoon, Black Hawk has 120 warriors on the south hilltop. The militia have about 650 to 700 men on the northern hilltop. And for the next 2 or 3 hours, they're just going to be firing back and forth, trying to basically use classical flanking maneuvers to basically get the other side. But Black Hawk basically just had to hold them off long enough so his people could cross. So you have this really sort of pitched battle involving probably upwards of about 800 men, you know, 120 Indians, 650 or 700 white militiamen. At the same time, you have women, children, and elderly Indians crossing the river about a half mile away.
And would you characterize Black Hawk's role as one that's impressive in terms of looking at it from a military point of view?
Yeah, I mean, there's only about maybe half a dozen firsthand accounts of the battle. There might be a dozen total, half a dozen that are really, you know, really descriptive, including Black Hawk's himself. And you can compare what Black Hawk says to what some of the white militiamen say, and they all pretty much jibe. I mean, you can tell that they're all basically telling the same story. But Black Hawk, you know, basically stood on top of the southern hilltop, mounted on a white horse, which I think kind of added to the spectacle, and he just told his men, stand firm. You know, we are going to basically hold these militiamen off so our people can cross the river. And if we have to give our lives to do it, that's what we're going to do. And out of 120 warriors, about 60 of them died. So, you know, that's a pretty horrific amount of casualties. So, yeah, it was really impressive. I mean, but you read story after story about Indian warriors and how they fought and, you know, just unbelievable courage, physical courage, moral courage, just an absolute, you know, lack of fear of dying, more so than white soldiers ever.
But this actually, this battle sounds more like, oh, this kind of thing we'd see later in the Civil War than what we think of as a classic sort of hand-to-hand close-quarter combat between white men and Indians.
Right. It never got down to hand-to-hand combat. Towards the end of the battle, and again, the white commander was essentially Henry Dodge. Okay, he had the most military experience. His men were the first one in contact with Black Hawk's people. He basically set up all the militiamen on the northern ridge. So he was really sort of the man in charge. And he was an impressive commander, too. I mean, what really became evident to me as I was looking at this was, you know, Black Hawk was an experienced Indian warrior commander, and it showed. He, you know, with 120 men, he held off 700 militia for, you know, better part of 2 or 3 hours. And Henry Dodge was impressive, too. He had a bunch of raw militiamen who had never seen combat, weren't trained, okay, didn't have nearly as much experience as Black Hawk's warriors in warfare. And he managed to basically have them hold their ground. There was, you know, there was not a repeat of Stillman's run, simply because Dodge was a better commander, better motivator of men.
What about weapons?
I think they were all using smoothbore flintlocks, both Indians and the militia.
So there was a pretty good supply, apparently, for the Indians. This wasn't just a matter of a few trade goods.
No. I would say that most Indians in the Great Lakes region, they had firearms well over a century before the Black Hawk War. I mean, so they, you know, firearms were not new to Indians. They had had them for a long time. So, yeah, every one of Black Hawk's warriors had a smoothbore musket and powder and knew how to use it.
Those great lead bullets coming out of Mineral Point.
Yeah, right. So the Indians and the militia, I think, were pretty equally armed. Neither side had artillery. So it was basically just small arms for the most part.
We're going to look at the conclusion of the Battle of Wisconsin Heights and its legacy when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. This was the most brilliant exhibition of military tactics that I ever witnessed, a feat of most consummate management and bravery in the face of an enemy of greatly superior numbers. I never read of anything that could be compared with it. Had it been performed by white men, it would have been immortalized as one of the most splendid achievements in military history. That's the comment of Jefferson Davis talking about the Battle of Wisconsin Heights in 1832 and its leader, Chief Black Hawk. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Patrick Young, and his book is called The Battle of Wisconsin Heights, 1832, Thunder on the Wisconsin. That's quite a comment by Jefferson Davis.
Yeah, and as I say, there were several people after the Black Hawk War, several white observers who either heard of the battle from other people or who were there, who were, you know, very much impressed with Black Hawk's leadership. Even, you know, several of the militiamen who, you know, wrote about the battle after the war, who had participated in it, were really impressed by Black Hawk's leadership. I mean, the fact that they outnumbered the Indians roughly 7-1, or at least 6-1, and they held, you know, they managed to hold the militia back for the better part of 2 hours before they could really get them to retreat off their hilltop. That was no small task. And again, Black Hawk was, you know, visible throughout the battle on top of the, you know, southern hilltop with, you know, top of a white horse. So, yeah, I mean, when you just think about, you know, the fact that he's outnumbered, he doesn't want to win. That's never his goal. It's just to hold back the militia long enough to effect this crossing of the river, and he does it. He gets every one of his people across, even the, you know, not, except for the dead. The only people that he didn't get across were the roughly 60 warriors who he lost, and most of them were Kickapoos, who had joined the Black Hawk's band back in 1830. And virtually all the Kickapoo warriors were killed. Only a few Sauk warriors were killed at the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, but virtually every Kickapoo warrior was killed. So it was just, yeah, it was really an incredible. And again, the fact is, in these Indian warriors, I mean, it's just the more you read about Indian warfare, they just sort of inured these young Indian boys to become warriors at a very young age. And they were just, you know, they were just brave to a fault. I mean, it's just incredible some of the things they did when they were engaged in warfare. I think even white observers were really just awestruck by the, you know, Black Hawk's, you know, leadership and by the just sheer tenacity of his warriors.
Well, now he has a superior strategic position because he's crossed the river. Mm-hmm. The pursuing whites are on the south side of the river. Mm-hmm. But how much can he do with that advantage?
Well, actually, he could do quite a lot. I mean, first of all, once he gets across the river, the militia the next day, and I'm not sure why they didn't, but You know, James D. Henry and Henry Dodge don't even attempt to cross the Wisconsin River. They know that Blackhawk's gotten across. They know that the rest of his band is now fleeing toward the Mississippi. Blackhawk got his people across mostly by taking, you know, making these flimsy makeshift canoes out of, you know, elm bark. I mean, they just, anything that could float was pushed across the Wisconsin River with women, children, even the horses got across. But Henry and Dodge didn't even attempt to get across the river. So Blackhawk had now put this obstacle between him and the white militiamen. And, you know, Dodge and Henry didn't even cross the river until about a week later when Atkinson and the rest of the army arrived. And they took the better part of 2 days to do it.
Well, so they've got a week or more head start. All
right.
this group of 1,000 of Blackhawk's people.
It was probably down to about 700 at that time, just from death and desertion.
They have a weak head start,
yes,
at least to get to the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you account for the disaster of the Battle of Bad Axe?
Well, Blackhawk, for whatever reason, thought that once he was across the Wisconsin River, he was free and clear. And at least initially he was, because, you know, there was no sign that, you know, Dodge and Henry were going to pursue him. So his people were, by that time, starvation had really set in. They started to kill horses and eat them. People were dying every day on the march to the Mississippi. So they were making their way very slowly to the Mississippi. And Blackhawk just didn't think he was being pursued. But within a week, Henry Atkinson had, you know, again brought the rest of the army. Again, most of Atkinson's army did not fight in the Battle of Wisconsin Heights. It was only Henry Dodge and, you know, James D. Henry who did. So Blackhawk has a weak head start, but he doesn't think he's being pursued. He thinks he's free and clear, so he's moving at something of a leisurely pace. He's not putting any rear scouts out to see if he's being pursued. So when they finally get to the Mississippi on August 1st, he figures, well, I'm free. I'm, you know, free and clear. We're starving. Things aren't going well, but, you know, there's nobody behind us. Well, by the time Atkinson gets across the river, he moves out a pretty good clip to the, you know, to follow Blackhawk's trail. And it's pretty easy to follow. The Blackhawk's people are, you know, they're digging graves for the, you know, newly dead. They're, you know, discarding equipment. So it's a pretty easy path to follow. And they start to notice as they're moving westward, Atkinson's men, that they see basically two Indian camps a day, sometimes three. So they were moving at least two or three times faster than Blackhawk. So by the time Blackhawk gets to the Mississippi on August 1st, Atkinson's only 10 miles away. 12 miles away at the most. So,
not
and Blackhawk
really
doesn't know he's there. That's the, that was the thing. Had Blackhawk known that Atkinson was, you know, basically caught up and was only a day behind him, I think he would have done something differently. What, I don't know, but
started across sooner.
Well, crossing the Mississippi is a lot more difficult than crossing the Wisconsin.
Sure. It's your only choice, though.
The only choice. Well, one of the things he did when he got to the Mississippi, he said, we should run to the Ojibwa country, which it was in northern Wisconsin. And he managed to convince 50 people to go with him. He wasn't at the Battle of Bad Axe, the final battle. And a lot of his followers were very angry that he left. But, you know, he did tell everybody, look, I think the best option at this point is to flee to the Ojibwa country. Most of his people said, no, we want to go back to the country of the Sauk and the Fox, and we're going to cross the Mississippi to do it. So he gave them a choice. Some people did go with him, about 50 people. But the vast majority, which is probably about 500, they decided to cross the Mississippi.
You write about the white volunteers at this point starting to shoot at anything, including women and children, deliberately so. And one of the volunteers even saying, when kind of called into question about shooting children, kill the nits and you'll have no lice.
Mm-hmm.
Why such I guess, violent attacks against the women and children?
Well, again, we go back to, you know, war is like anything else. There's cultural reasons for doing it. For Indians, it was for, you know, to gain social prestige. It was an individual set of actions that a warrior engaged in, you know, to get scalps, to basically gain manhood. For, you know, white frontiersmen and to some degree the federal government, the purpose of war was to show Indians what happens to them if they rise up against the federal government. They are going to be destroyed. And the reason they're going to be destroyed is simply so they can be an example to other Indians of what will happen to them. So, again, there was really not, at least on Atkinson's part, he certainly didn't encourage his men to kill women and children. But he certainly didn't go out of his way to make sure it didn't happen either.
Plus, these things, as we know, can get out of hand, too,
right.
Especially if you have militia rather than relatively disciplined
right.
troops.
Right. And, you know, I'm sure even some of the regulars might have, you know, engaged in some atrocities. But there was just this mindset that these Indians have to be punished. And again, I don't think that Atkinson encourages men to, you know, shoot women and children. That's certainly nothing in the historical record that indicates that. But nothing that indicates he tried to prevent it or stop it or anything else either. And by that time, I mean, you know, at the Battle of Wisconsin Heights, Black Hawk, his men, his warriors were outnumbered about 6-1. Now there's well over 1,000, you know, militia and regulars, and now he's hopelessly outnumbered. They don't have the advantage of terrain. They're in a low-lying, swampy area. So, I mean, they had just no advantages. So, they were really heavily outnumbered. They don't have the advantage of terrain, and they aren't effectively getting across the river. So the Battle of Bad Axe was just a massacre.
And surrender is not an option.
Well, you know, some of the women and children did surrender, and they were taken as prisoners. Okay, I mean, not every white militiaman or regular at the Battle of Bad Axe was going to kill women and children, but some were. So some women and children did surrender and were taken as prisoners. The battlefield itself, the Battle of Bad Axe, was probably fought on a piece of terrain that stretches for at least a mile and a half, 2 miles. So we're not talking about, you know, a real small area. We're talking about, you know, something relatively large area with pockets of people.
A diffuse action.
Yeah.
So how many actually got across the Mississippi?
Probably about 200 at least. Another 260 were probably killed at the battle. And then probably, I have to look at all my numbers in the book, but a few hundred taken prisoner.
So out of the original roughly 1,000, we're down to about 250.
Right.
Counting the ones that went up north with Black Hawk.
Right. There's been several estimates of how many Indians, you know, were with Black Hawk and how many of them died. The best estimates are Black Hawk started with 1,100 people. And probably about 200 or 300 abandoned him at some point during the war. Probably about 500 were killed. Okay, might have been, you know, may have been 400, but, you know, probably almost close to 50% were either killed from starvation or from, you know, massacres and battles and
not to mention drowning.
Not to mention drowning. A lot of them drowned in the Mississippi.
So. You talk about Black Hawk being captured and sort of paraded around like a celebrity in a way. It's kind of a sad tale.
Well, actually, his trip, ultimately the Winnebago find him on his way to the Ojibwe country. He's taken to Fort Crawford, which is at Prairie du Chien. He's taken down from there to St. Louis, where he spends the fall and winter of 1832, 1833 in the stockade. And then in April of 1833, about a year after the war started, he's sent to Washington to account for his actions in front of Andrew Jackson. And, and he was basically just a celebrity on the East Coast. He was, you know, he went in front of Jackson, did his sort of, you know, ceremonial contrition. Jackson basically sentenced him to live in the stockade at Fort Monroe, Virginia. He was only there for a month. I think Jackson finally decided, well, you know, his followers have been dispersed or killed. By that time, Black Hawk's rival, Keokuk, was made the official chief of the Sauk and the Fox. So in order to make sure Black Hawk never rose up again, Jackson said, well, take him on a tour of Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York. Have him see how big the United States really is. And he was shocked. Black Hawk had no idea how many white people there actually were. He was just absolutely just awestruck by the size of all these cities. Just didn't know. He had seen, you know, small little cities like Detroit or St. Louis, which probably had fewer than 1,000, you know, white settlers. So he had just no idea how big the United States was. I mean, the Sauk had a total of 5,000 people. The Fox had a total of about 1,600. So Indians just weren't used to 30 or 40,000 people, which is the size of some of the larger cities on the East Coast.
Patrick Young, thank you for being our guide through the Black Hawk War and the Battle of Wisconsin Heights.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.